My guest in the second hour, Glenn Duncan, unquestionably a legend. You will not believe, if you don't know of Glenn, you probably do and don't realize that he's recorded and toured with Bill Monroe, Earl Scruggs. He's on so many albums it's impossible to name them all, really. He has new music, which we will talk about. First of a two-part visit with Glenn Duncan. So many great stories. He covers it all. He is a singer, songwriter, producer, performer, musician, Grammy. It just goes on and on and on. You will enjoy this a lot. And Glenn Duncan, again, pops up again in the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band, one of their albums that they did for the Circle Collection, as you remember. You're going to hear John McEwen. It's his tune, Return to Dismal Swamp. On the tune is Glenn Duncan. He's everywhere, I'm telling you. I'm so glad to have Glenn in the second hour. Stick around. You're going to enjoy this. Glenn's an absolutely remarkable historian. Has played with everyone, has stories about everybody. You won't hear them all, I guarantee you, but you're going to hear a lot of them. There to the audience of Unreal Bluegrass, you just heard a brand new single, Lonesome for Your Blues, from my very special guest today on Unreal Bluegrass. First time. Very honored to have Glenn Duncan. How are you, Glenn?
Oh, doing great, Steve. How about you? And let me say, I'm honored to be with you.
Well, thank you. In preparing for this show, Glenn, and we're going to talk about, I want to talk about the song that we just played so the audience can know why we played it. But in preparing for this song, once I started thinking about doing it, I realized that trying to gather in Glenn Duncan's career, legendary career, my words, not yours, would be like trying to lasso a Category 5 tornado. You just can't pull it in. You can't pull it in. So we're going to cover things as they come up.
Sure.
There's so much to cover, and there's so many people that I know that you've worked with, and so many legendary characters in the music field. But we're going to talk about music with you, and we're going to cover what we do. And I'm very informal about this. You need to know
up
front.
It's going to be fun.
It's going to be a blast. It's going to be a blast. So you have we'll start off with you have a new CD in the works, I think, coming out. That's where that song came. Talk a little bit about the very first song that we heard, the Lonesome for Your Blues, and then we'll kind of go from there.
Okay. I'll tell you how that came about, and that's for the Englehart Music Group. That's EMG Records here in Nashville, and Adam Englehart and I produce every record that Englehart Music Group does, and so we've in the process of doing an album with Don Schlitz, the Country Music Hall of Famer, Fast Track, some of our great friends who have a great act and a great album coming out, Jim and Dennis Crouch, Joe Hawk, that we produce his records, and Eddie Sanders. And Eddie Sanders and I actually wrote Lonesome for You Blues, and the way that song came about, because songs, you know, they start out all different ways. Lots of times I'll have a title. The title is always, as often as not, it starts with a title. I will always usually start working a song from the angle of a chorus. So I'm still a firm believer, if you've got a hooky, great chorus, you have a hit song. And then the verses, you know, obviously the craft of writing a song, you know, will take you there. But that particular song actually started with the fiddle lick. And I had that fiddle lick that you just heard on the record, that da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. I actually had that. That was my first thing. I just loved that, and it's in B minor, you know, on the fiddle. And I thought, man, this is so cool. And it's one of those songs that I always like songs. I call them new songs that sound old. So it sounds like an old song. But I had that. So I had the fiddle thing, and that was going to be where we started. So when Eddie and I got together to write, we sat down, and I said, man, I got this thing on the fiddle. And I said, I'm going to play that for you. And so I played that, and then I always write on a guitar or a piano, but 95% of the time it's on a guitar. And so then I picked up the guitar and I said, and here's the chords. And then Eddie and I started talking about, you know, what does that fiddle lick make us think of? And then that's how, because the fiddle lick ends, da, 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 da. So then that became Lonesome for You Blues, Lonesome for You Blues. And that became Old Man. That's all we needed. You know, so we had the fiddle lick, which was the melody of the song. And then we had Lonesome for You Blues. And then it became a fiddle player telling the story of late at night. I'm hurting just a little, you know, a melody, you know, my solve the riddle. Those kind of words, because it was all going to be about, I can picture, which is always how I write a song, picturing this scene, and Lonesome for You Blues, the scene is like this guy, it's late at night, it's really late at night, it's dark outside, it's raining outside, it's stormy outside, and his woman has left him, and there's no hope, and so I'm Lonesome for You Blues, and the only thing is to pull the fiddle out and play this song, and that's what we did. We wrote that song, and I recorded it, and it's from an upcoming album for EMG that we're really excited about.
I can't wait. Now, you know, because we talked a little bit off the air, a little bit, mm-hmm. but I know Adam. You know that I know Adam.
Yes.
And I've known Adam for longer than I can really remember. Yeah. And yeah. We crossed our terms on the IBMA board overlap just a little bit.
Yeah.
So I got to meet him, and he's just a nice guy. I know that you think the world of Adam and what he's doing
in the
studio.
Yes, that's how the whole EMG, you know, Making Bluegrass Records all goes back to I had written a song called Jesus Built a Bridge to Heaven. Kevin Grant and I wrote that song together, and after we wrote it, this is, oh gosh, going on 20 years ago. And we wrote that song, and Buddy Cannon, who is Kenny Chesney's producer, and he produced George Jones. I did a lot of sessions for Buddy with George Jones. I did a lot of sessions for Buddy with John Michael Montgomery. Lots of different acts. And Buddy heard the song. And actually, Larry Schell, the great songwriter, one of the best songwriters I know, he heard that song and loved it. And called me and said, "Man, I just heard this song, Jesus Built a Bridge to Heaven. Love it." And he said, "He said everybody's got to hear this song. And when Shell believes in your song, everybody's going to hear your song." And he used to be head of A&R for Harold Shedd. So I mean, a lot of the records that Alabama recorded are songs that Larry Shell found for Harold Shedd in Alabama, and then also. Larry Cordell and I, when we started Lonesome Standard Time, Larry and I did three albums together as Lonesome Standard Time. Some of the very best songs we did were songs that Larry Schell wrote with Cordell, and that was Mama Don't Forget to Pray for Me, and some of those just really, you know, Feels a Home is another one that comes to mind. And so Shell just a really respected song man. And so he played Jesus Built a Bridge to Heaven for Buddy Cannon. Well, Buddy Cannon was getting ready to record a gospel album on Ned Beatty. So you never
now
know.
Just for the people that are listening in, that's the Ned Beatty that they know from the movies.
Yes, yes, Superman and Deliverance and all that stuff. I mean, that is, you know, another good, great friend of mine that I've worked a lot in the studio with is Ronnie Cox, another actor who was, his very first movie was Deliverance, and that was Ronnie's first movie, and Ned, of course, was in Deliverance. I always think of him in the Superman movies, you know.
Or Network, he was the boss in Network.
Yeah,
yeah, scary guy.
Just a great guy. And so then, so Ned Beatty's going to record the song. And so he records the song, and then they called from the studio and said, you know, Ned really wants to meet you and Kevin. So Kevin and I went to the studio and met Ned Beatty. I have a great picture of Kevin and I with Ned Beatty that's great. So that was the first cut on Jesus Built a Bridge to Heaven. Rhonda Vincent heard the song. She wanted to record it. Because she was doing a gospel album and literally needed one more song, and she was looking for something that had this kind of a thing that song has. So she recorded. So the two of them, you know, so that was the first two cuts on it. Rhonda's cut, Ned Beatty's cut, and then the Blind Boys of Alabama's manager heard the song. Probably about 2004, I think it would have been. He caught, is that right? 2009 is probably, no, it was 2004. Let me think a minute here. 2009, maybe. And anyway, said, can you write me another song that's something like that? They really love Jesus Built a Bridge to Heaven, and they want to do something just like it. And I said, oh, man, yes, I can. So then wrote I Know a Place, and they ended up recording both of them. They recorded Jesus Built a Bridge to Heaven and then I Know a Place. Well, so as this all goes back towards Adam and EMG, Adam, who's head of all recording, too, for Sony Music in Nashville, all of it, the studios, the whole bit, and he was getting ready to produce an album on Curly Putman, the Hall of Fame, you know, Nashville Songwriters Hall of Fame songwriter. Curly wrote Green Green Grass at Home. He wrote with Bobby Braddock, He Stopped Loving Her Today. He also wrote My Elusive Dreams, D-I-V-O-R-C-E.
That's a powerful resume right there for a songwriter.
Oh, my God. Oh, and almost every hit that T.G. Shepherd ever did. And, I mean, it just the list of songs that he wrote is Older the Violin, The Sweeter the Music. There's a great George Jones song that he wrote, too, that I love called Couldn't Love Have Picked a Better Place to Die. There's just a zillion of them. Well, so Adam's producing an album on Curly. And, you know, he told Curly, he said, man, so, you know, we need to get Glenn to play on this, play guitar. And, you know, of course, he'll play some fiddle, but, you know, play acoustic guitar because I play a lot of acoustic on you know, sessions over the last many years. and so I come into the studio to overdub. I'm overdubbing the guitar and overdubbing the fiddle. So it's just me and Curly and Adam down at one of Sony's studios. And same thing about Jesus Built a Bridge to Heaven. So I come in, you know, and I'd met Curly, but, you know, I had not, you know, worked with him for like 4 or 5 hours like this was going to be. And so, you know, so we're talking to Curly, and he goes, man, he said, I heard a song that you wrote that I just love. And I said, what's that? And he said, Jesus Built a Bridge to Heaven. I said, really? And so come to find out, he'd been listening to a lot of bluegrass, and he'd heard Rhonda's record of it. And so Curly says, he said, you know, he said, we need to get together and write some bluegrass songs. And I said, we do. You just say when. And so Curly said, well, he said, why don't you and Adam come out and the three of us will write a song. So I said, that'd be great. So like a Friday, you know, like maybe the following Friday or a week from that Friday or whatever, a Friday morning, Adam and I each drove out to Curly's Green Grass Acres outside of Lebanon, which is a very historic place because that's where Paul McCartney and Linda stayed the entire time they were in Nashville recording that first album that they did here. In fact, there's a song on there called Junior's Farm, and it's Curly was Junior.
I remember seeing the pictures, but I would have never connected who Junior was.
Yeah, that. Yeah, that was he. It was like 135 acres or something, and a pond and everything else. It was a great place, and so Adam and I each drive out there. It was a really rainy, overcast morning. You know, you pull up to the gate, you know, hey, this is Glenn. Yeah, come on in. You go down this really long driveway that you see in all the documentary stuff about the Paul McCartney thing, except they're shooting from the house, looking out towards the road rather than back at the house. Pull up, and Curly had this huge music room built on the end of the house. And so Adam Englehart and I, each, you know, we get there and go in Curly's music room, and the three of us sat down and wrote a bluegrass song called Deep Dark Hollow Road. And Del McCurry Band ended up recording it, and it's the very first line in it is Loretta. That's the very first thing is Loretta. That's the girl's name. And Ronnie McCurry had heard it, and he called me late one night and said, hey, I like that song that y'all wrote, said Loretta. And I said, I know the very one you're talking about. So Adam and I and Curly Putman wrote Deep Dark Hollow Road. Del McCurry Band records it on. Del McCurry still sings bluegrass, which to me for an ex bluegrass boy, to me that was as good as it gets, because you know Del McCurry Sings Bluegrass was one of my favorite albums.
It's a great one. It's a great one.
Oh,
it gets a lot of airplay on Unreal Bluegrass, and I know I've played that song before, but you know, it's fantastic.
And so Deep Dark Hollow Road was the first one. The second song we wrote was Whole Lotta Layin' Around. Same thing, Adam, me, and Curly, and Chris Roberts. We ended up cutting it on Chris, and Chris had a big bluegrass hit on it. So Adam and I start writing together and writing with Curly and writing with other people. We've written a whole bunch of songs with Eddie Sanders, and then we've written a bunch. We wrote a song with Larry Stevenson called Blue Memories that's out now.
Mm-hmm.
It's out at this time. It's great. And, boy, Larry and his band, you know, they got every bit of it. It's an incredible record. Ralph Stanley, Ralph 2, we still call him.
Yep.
He too did one of our songs, and gosh, you know. So then we started doing writing a bunch. Joe Hotz done a bunch of our songs. We wrote a song with Joe called West Virginia Rail, and which interestingly enough, the idea that I had for that actually. Was for, right from your part of the country, because it had always been a powerful thing to me when I started playing and traveling all over, because I'm from Columbus, Indiana, Southern Indiana, and the Southern Indiana, Southern Ohio, and Northern Kentucky, like my grandfather, when he left Jamestown, Kentucky, literally got on Highway 31. And I mean, he didn't have a car, you know, hitchhiking, and they would literally just go north till they saw smokestacks.
Exactly right. That's what they all did. Yep.
That's what they did, you know, and try to get a job in a factory. And he got all the way to Franklin, Indiana, and went to work for a company called Indianapolis Pump and Tube. He was the second employee they ever hired. It's now Arvin Industries. You know, he stayed for like 45 years and became a general foreman and all that stuff. But the West Virginia Rail thing with Joe was, he's from West Virginia. So I like that idea about, you know, something to do with West Virginia and, you know, to introduce him to the bluegrass world. But the theme of it I wanted to be, and I, you know, I lived in Kentucky, four different places in Kentucky. I lived in Sand Springs, Kentucky, Berea, Kentucky, Grayson, Kentucky, and Lexington, Kentucky. And so I really, and then doing, you know, bluegrass for a living, and so powerful to me how so many people would be from wherever they were from in Kentucky or West Virginia, you know, they'd move to Middletown, they'd move to Dayton, they'd move to, you know, Franklin or County or whatever, Middletown or Connersville, Indiana, all those places. They'd moved, but they never, ever gave up the idea of, when I tell you one thing, when I get enough money to retire, I'm moving back.
That's
now.
That's exactly right.
And they were UK fans, you know, Sonny and Bobby.
Oh,
you know,
gosh.
Biggest UK fans on the planet.
Still.
In our bus, you know, when I was traveling with the Osmond Brothers, you know, we listened to three things. We listened to the Opry if we were on the road. We listened to Charlie Douglas's all-night radio show out of, he was in Louisiana. Slidell. He was in Slidell, Louisiana. And, I mean, they had three radios in that bus because Raymond Huffmaster was our bus driver. He had it going up front. Bobby had it going in his room, and Sonny had it going in the back in his room. They all three listened to the same thing. And then when UK was playing, buddy, it was UK on the radio, and you never saw either one of them without them having a UK ball cap or UK towel, something. So the idea with Joe was, the whole idea of West Virginia Rail was, boy, when I get old enough and I have done my time at the factory, first thing I'm doing is getting on the train and riding back to home, which is West Virginia for him. So that was the whole idea of that song. So all of these songs had a you know, like a theme. And so with Joe, it was that one. And so all these songs started being recorded. And at the same time, Adam and I produced a record on Chris Roberts, a single called Boeing 707. which is a Roger Miller song. And Adam, he knows that catalog. It's Sony better than anybody on the planet. All the old Acuff Row stuff, he knows Roger Miller. Everybody that wrote there, you know, such a between Tree and Acuff Row, they're all under the same umbrella now. I mean, gosh, you're talking about Don Gibson, you know, Harlan, Hank Cochran, all these guys. Roger Miller. Bill Anderson still writes there. He still writes there. Bobby Braddock still writes there. Curly, when he passed away, he was still a Sony writer, you know, because they bought Tree. And so, I mean, this iconic foundation of the music business and the music. So he knew that song. Adam knew that song. Said, boy, this would be a great bluegrass song. So we produced He and I Together. Boeing 707 became a big hit for Chris. So we started doing a whole album on him. At the same time, Eddie Sanders, whose dad I knew so well, Freddie Sanders, because Freddie had the big, big bluegrass festival in McAlester, Oklahoma. And that was just a, man, I mean, like, there was a couple things, like with the Osmond Brothers, that would start a whole week. We would go to McAlester, and we had a whole circuit that we would play every single year, the same show. But I'd played it with Bill Monroe. I'd played it with Jim and Jesse. And so I knew the family, you know, very well. And Eddie, he's actually one of the best songwriter artists that I've run across at any time. Just a really, really, really good songwriter, a natural songwriter, and a really good singer. So we wrote a bunch of songs with Eddie and still write a bunch of songs with Eddie. We've written, you know, three or four here just in the last little while again. And some of them other people have done, a bunch of them Eddie's done. So we produced an album on Eddie. And produced a gospel album on Eddie. And so pretty soon, you know, EMG was in a big way in the bluegrass business. And so that's what Adam and I produced all the records and write songs. And it's been just one of the most enjoyable chapters of my life and career.
And the career, if you just tuned in, I'm talking to Glenn Duncan. If you just listened to this and didn't know Glenn, except for these last few minutes, you would think, well, Steve has a famous songwriter. I do. But we've not even gotten, Glenn, to your instrumental, to your musicianship. Grammy Award-winning musician, award-winning songwriter, which we talked a little bit about.
Yeah.
But your history in music and bluegrass and studio work is just incomparable. And I want to take just a minute, now that we've done this current bit about the songwriting, which we've barely scratched the surface on what you've been writing. But let's start with little Glenn Duncan being exposed to bluegrass, because you have some great have some great stories about Bill Monroe as a child.
And
you later play with Bill Monroe. You played with Earl. And just so start. Let's take back that a little bit, because your career as a musician is amazing. And your songwriting now and producing is following that same track. But Glenn Duncan, your career as a musician, which is not over, I don't mean to imply that.
Oh, no.
It's just phenomenal. You're still recording, but let's get back to where all this started for you.
Yes, it starts for me. My dad, because I was born in Columbus, Indiana, and my dad was actually had been drafted, and he was actually in Okinawa when I was born. And so my mother and I lived with my paternal grandparents, which was my dad's mom and dad. They were music fans. My grandfather, his favorite was Roy Acuff. So he had Roy Acuff 78s and albums had already, you know, come into, because I was born in 1955, which is the last year that they made 78s, interestingly enough. And but they had this huge record collection, which I still have. As I sit here in my studio office here at on part of my house here, and I still have all the 78s. And my grandmother was the world's biggest Bill Monroe fan. They had all the Columbia 78s, all of them, that Bill and you know, Lester and Earl and Chubby and Howard Watts did, and had them all, had all the, and played the quartets a ton. They had one Decca, 78, and it's on the old Kentucky shore. I think Poison Love's on the other side, if I remember. But boy, that on the old Kentucky shore, there was something magical about. There's something about the sound, and you and I have talked about this about the sound. There's a sound that, and they had Foggy Mountain Breakdown by Flatt and Scruggs, the Mercury Cut, and they had Little Maggie. Which came along when I was about five or six, the Stanley Brothers. But going back to my dad, so then when my dad gets out of the service, my dad had been a musician. He'd been a musician. He'd played the Brown County Jamboree, which everybody knows today as Bean Blossom. But it was a barn. It was a show barn. Like there was, you know, those places all over southern Indiana, Ohio. We used to play a bunch of the parks, you know, Sunset Park, Rising Sun Park, Frontier Ranch in Columbus, Ohio. They were all over the place because, again, kind of our theme here of all these people had moved up from Kentucky to get jobs. But when they did, they took the music with them, which, interestingly enough, Earl Scruggs and I were in a movie. And the theme of the movie is this young fella, the story in the movie is when he left Ireland because of the potato famine and came to America, his grandfather like grabs him in this scene and says, take the music with you, take the music with you. And so the part that Earl and I play, and Randy, it's Earl Scruggs, Randy Scruggs, and me. And because this particular scene is advancing through time. So there's the 1940s, the 1950s, and it doesn't get up past the 50s. So we, the three of us, are on a train. We're on a train, and we're playing Foggy Mountain Breakdown on this train. But the whole idea of the movie was take the music with you. Well, that's what everybody did. From Kentucky and West Virginia and Virginia, when they moved north to get, you know, factory jobs and really automotive related.
That's
factory,
right. Yep.
Factory work.
Yep.
And you know, these companies were all making parts for, you know, Ford and Chevy and Studebaker and all these other companies, in Auburn, Indiana, and they'd taken this music with them. So Bean Blossom, Indiana. Had a show barn called the Brown County Jamboree, and they would broadcast on Saturday nights, just before Bill Monroe bought it. So Dad was playing over there, and then Dad got drafted. He saw the world when he got back from, you know, being abroad. He went to college on the GI Bill, wasn't a professional musician anymore, and became a mechanical engineer and a machine tool dealer, but he was still that same guy who was a musician. So my whole life was filled with, there were records. He bought records incessantly. I mean, he literally would go to a record store probably twice a week and buy records. He bought records. So at one point he had over 2,000 records. I mean, he was just a record buyer. And then we had instruments in the house. We had a D18, a Gibson Archtop, we had and Dad had bought a harp guitar at some point because he saw a Gibson Archtop advertised in the local paper and went and it ended up being a harp guitar.
Did you ever play that? Did you ever try to play that?
Oh, I did, yeah. Mm-hmm. Some of my dad's old publicity. And Dad ended up trading it to George Gruen for a newer one of the, when Martin first started making those, you know, like an HD-28.
Oh, yeah.
I think George traded him that and I guess a Gretsch nylon string, which was actually a really great guitar that I actually still have around here somewhere amongst all these guitars. And so we had instruments, and so people say, you know, because you get asked a lot, you know, well, how old were you when you started playing? And actually, the answer is, I have no idea, because I was always trying to play. There's a great picture, one of the family pictures. My dad is literally sitting there playing an L50 Gibson, and he's, like, really young, you know. And this one-year-old kid is, like, standing there, evidently they put me up on the arm of the chair or something, you know, like a big, you know, big overstuffed chair. And I've literally got both hands grabbing the neck. I've got to get this thing. I've got to get this. And I'm literally, you know, one or 2 years old. And so I was always trying to make that sound that I heard. I always wanted to make that sound. It was the sound. Even my very earliest recollections of anything to do with music, it was, there was a sound that came out of those records. And I understood that, you know, that these were guys doing it. But there's one added thing to it about growing up in that particular time frame, was there was a mystique about it, you know, because you didn't see them. There was no way to see what they were doing when they made that record. You know, there's not a picture of Lester and Earl and Benny Sims, you know, playing Foggy Mountain Breakdown in the studio. There's, you know, we don't have film footage of them, you know, like we do now of even, you know, the Rolling Stones recording in, you know, 1970 or something. Man, you could watch the whole video. So there was such a mystique.
You just had that record to stare at.
Yes.
And, you know, and your imagination just, I'll get you.
That's the home run right there. So when you're, the whole time, you're sitting there, and there's also something about the process, I think, you know, as you're a little kid, you know, even coming back from school and you're already playing guitars. We had a piano in the house, so I was learning how to play piano, which I, you know, ended up playing piano. I played piano on some Doyle Lawson albums and a bunch of other people's records. But thank God we had a piano, and I've said this a lot. To people who have a young, you know, person who's really interested in playing music as a career, I will say, well, how'd you do it? You know, and I kind of go through how I did it. I said, well, I had really good instruments in the house and professional quality instruments in the house. We had a great record collection, and we had a piano. And because the thing about a piano is when you learn to play the piano, you can see the notes. So I never had to think about chord structure and stuff because I could see them. You know, so even today now when I'm doing three fiddles on a record, you know, well, I know what the third part is technically because I learned to play piano. But there's one little funny story I was gonna tell you about that piano. Now this is where, you know, like Providence is shining all over, you know, little Glenn Duncan. So this piano had a piano bench, and in a piano bench you have sheet music. So in this piano bench one day, you know, because I'm playing piano, and that's the way I would be. I would be like, oh, my gosh, I got hooked on playing piano. Played piano one entire summer. That's all I did all summer long. The whole time school was, I played piano all day. And I would still play guitar or whatever else I was playing at the time. Banjo had already, you know, bit me real bad. But this piano bench, I opened the piano bench, and there's a guitar chord book in there. And it's no ordinary guitar, and I have tried to find a copy of this same guitar chord book. Because I knew all these chords on a guitar, I mean, you know, like minor 7, flat 5s, and all that, but I didn't know the names of them. I had just worked them out by ear, you know, the passing chords, you know, like that is a, you know, some people call it it's half diminished is what we call it most of the time. But, you know, so I figured out diminished and half diminished and augmented and all that stuff. But I didn't know the names of them. And I just knew, well, you know, if you're, you know, want to set up this E chord, you know, boy, if you play this is really cool right here. This B half diminished, you know, man, but I didn't know what the name of it was. So there's a guitar chord book in there.
Do you by chance remember the name of the book?
I do. That's the interesting
thing. Okay, you get the. I cut you off. Go ahead.
Yeah. No. Because that's the. And again, I have tried to find this book somewhere, and I can't find a copy of it anywhere. It was Guckert's Guchert _S Guckert's chord book, and this guy on the front. It's a real. Well, I'll tell you what. It's the same exact colors and artwork as the Bill Monroe Stars of the Bluegrass Hall of Fame album that I played on in 85. Same colors, same blue and orange and whatever that is. But it's almost like the same kind of artwork that Gibson used in their catalogs in the 20s. In fact, it's exactly the same deal because the guy's got like button shoes and all. So I'm assuming it's from the 20s or 30s. But Steve, here's where I hit the home run. It's the best chord book I've ever seen in my life for guitar. It had everything, and it was presented in such a way. And I'm like, I don't know, 7 years old or something, and I could still understand it. You know, maybe I'm probably 10, but I could understand. Oh, okay. So it didn't get so far. You know, sometimes it gets so far into an 11th and a 13th and all that, and the, you know, extended chords. And I understand that that's a way to teach people, but to me it was nowhere near as effective as – actually, the Nashville chord system has a – we use a really good way of doing it. We will refer to a chord as a 4 over 5. It's like the Wichita lineman chord right at the – you know, when they make that. It's like a B flat over C. Or a C over D, those I really like thinking of it in terms of that, because that is like, okay, well, that's, you know, B flat chord, and the bass player is playing a C. That, to me, that makes all kinds of sense, and that's the way we write it out. You know, if I'm writing a chart, everything's going to be, it's a 4/5, you know, or it's a 2/1. You know, it's not an 11th or a 13th or something, because then that opens up a whole other can of worms. But anyway, Gugart's chord book is in this piano bench. And so that was like my whole childhood. I'm trying to make that sound. And then my mom was a huge Ray Price fan. She still is. And huge. That's her favorite singer on the planet. Still yet, of all the things I've done, playing TV shows with Ray Price is right. That would be one of the 4 or 5, you know, that towards the top, because she loved Ray Price that much. And so we went to the Crunk Theater in Columbus, Indiana, to see Ray Price and the Cherokee Cowboys. This would be early 63. And the steel guitar player was from Indiana, Mishawaka, Indiana, and with Buddy Emmons. And, of course, he and I worked together a ton later, and he was like my first real musical hero. I think the best way to explain this is, so I had been going to Bean Blossom to the Barn on Sundays my entire life. So I knew Bill Monroe my whole life. So I knew Bill Monroe. I knew it was great, and I loved a bunch of the songs. But I saw him a lot. And so at that point, it hadn't just completely taken over like it did later. But I saw Emmons. And the interesting thing about this is, as I told Buddy that story probably 100 times, about seeing him. And the first record that I ever paid, that I ever bought with my own money, was a 45 of Buddy that they had at our local records music store. And it's four-wheel drive on one side, and Blue Wind is on the other side. On deck, I've still got it, still got the original sleeve and everything else. But the interesting thing about this story is he had just started with Ray Price. So had I not gone just at that particular point in time, I wouldn't have seen Buddy Emmons. So, but I did see Buddy Emmons, and then I had to have a steel guitar. So I became a little kid steel player. At 7, 8 years old, 9 years old, that's all I did all the time, was play steel guitar. I still love steel guitar. I've got a couple of them in my studio office here.
And you've got a really good one right there in your studio office.
Yeah, they're the Rolls Royce for me. And I mean, I never got over Buddy on steel. You know, I mean, he was just such a genius is, you know, bandied about a lot, but he indeed was. And he created so many different things. I mean, even about, you know, how they're made and how you tune a C6 neck. Well, you know, what's going to be the tuning on the C6? I mean, he came up with it in less than a week. You know, and then the push-pull steel that he invented. He invented that.
He's kind of like the Les Paul.
That's it.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And then to become the, you know, I use this, you know, kind of to explain how I think about Buddy a lot. Is Buddy is like if Stradivari and Paganini had been the same guy. that's pretty much
that's a lot.
That's pretty much it. And really, that's, you know, I think of Earl Scruggs the same way with the banjo was, because I always think of Earl Scruggs and Bill Monroe this way. So they started where there wasn't nothing, and they come up with a whole lot of songs.
Well, you're right.
There was no way, and still today, Earl hit WSM in 1945. Still today, as we sit here and talk about this music that we're so passionate about, we still love. I mean, it's been, you know, just the core of our life, you know, things that we enjoy. There's still, after all this time, no way, I say it this way, you would have to consciously make an effort, and it would be a bad effort. The results wouldn't be
very pleasing. No, they wouldn't be very pleasing.
Yeah, to play a 5-string banjo in any kind of ensemble music that has a, you know, like the rhythmic pulse of bluegrass, let's say. Let's just say that, you know, the rhythmic pulse of bluegrass, something's got that train beat and all. You have to play like Earl Scruggs. There is no other way that you are going to play. You can play things that Alan Shelton played in the Scruggs style, J.D. Crowe, Sonny Osborne, you know, whoever. But at the core of it, it all comes back to what Earl developed himself. Because there is, I put it this way too, in all of music history, there will be moments. And when Earl Scruggs came to Nashville in 1945, it changed everything, and not just the banjo, but everything about kind of the rhythmic structure of how a string band makes music. And that, I always put it this way, you can always tell when a person is a source, and we're going to talk about that in just a second. Bill Monroe's the same way. There is no almost Bill Monroe and then Bill Monroe. There is no almost Earl Scruggs and then Earl Scruggs.
Yeah, I like that. That's exactly right.
There is no guy who where you go, oh, well, I see where he got that, because there ain't one. They both came, and they were the right guy at the right time, and they had the right set of tools. I'm talking about intellectually, musically, and music as an emotion and how to put that emotion across to other people. But they both understood at a very fundamental level, they felt and knew rhythm in a way that had not been done before them. And with Bill, if you think about everything that Bill did do, I mean, if he had done nothing else than decide that the mandolin should be played the mandolin chop that we just all take for granted now, well, yeah, that's how you do it. It hadn't been done, you know, it like that. You know, this is going to be the backbeat of the music right here. Here it is. And from the time he started doing that until the day till he played True Life Blues, which was the last thing he ever sang in his life, and he sang it on the Grand Ole Opry. And now let me tell you a little thing about that. I've talked to Tom Ewing about this a lot. What bigger thing could be a capstone to Bill Monroe as a public music personality than True Life Blues? And here's why. So the last line that Bill Monroe ever sang to an audience, number one, it went right out over 50,000 watts WSM. But the other thing is, True Life Blues, the last line is, this story is sad, but it's a true life. It's a true life. That's the last thing the man ever said, and that is exactly the way Bill Monroe's music was. It was sad, but it was a true life, and it was about him. It was about him. And then you take Earl Scruggs. Scruggs comes in 45, and all of a sudden, now you've got all the pieces that it takes to make the rhythm thing that people still love about bluegrass today.
Yeah, and that's, you know, the other thing about, too, another way of putting it for both Bill Monroe and Earl Scruggs, these are just my words, it wasn't like they jumped ahead 20 or 30 years. They jump sideways. It wasn't a natural progression if they cut in front of someone in line. It's like all of a sudden they're not just following the tradition. All of a sudden they're over there, and it wouldn't necessarily have happened without them, I believe.
Yeah. That's right. You know, I got of course, I had played a lot with Earl from the mid-'80s all the way through till 2012 when we lost him. But for 8 years, I was with him all the time. And a lot of times it would be Earl and Louise and me. The three of us who traveled together. We'd go to fly to L.A. to do something with somebody, Dwight Yoakam or Melissa Etheridge or you name it, different people out there, or do one of the TV shows. And same thing, we'd fly to New York. So we flew together a lot. And so we talked all the time, and that's all we did was talk and laugh and have a big time, just like we're doing. It's the same thing. And I remember asking him several different times, but I asked him one time, I said, Earl, I said, when did you know? I said, so when you started playing on the Grand Ole Opry, I said, when did you know that, oh, boy, I'm on to something? And now this is a really heavy.
That's a great question, too.
Yeah, and it's a heavy thing to think about because all of our thinking about Bill Monroe and Earl Scruggs and, you know, Chubby and Lester Flatt, you know, all the Ralph, you know, the Stanley brothers, is all looking back. And they're already Mount Rushmore. You know, they're already iconic figures. Our whole lives, even though, you know, bluegrass had not been around 300 years. Nevertheless, you know, by the time I'm, you know, say 15, well, you know, by the time I'm 15, you know, there's already a festival at Bean Blossom. It's already in its fourth or fifth year, and, you know, bluegrass is like a big thing, you know. And by the time I'm 15, they're putting Monroe in the Country Music Hall of Fame. So it's we're looking back, but at the time, so I asked him, I said, Earl, I said, when's the first time that you knew? And now here's a real interesting thing, because this is a real good picture into what the Grand Ole Opry was like in 1945. And I said, so Earl, when did you know that you really were on to something? And now the little tiny backstory here is, up to that point on the Opry, the big star, of course, Roy Acuff has gotten big. He's gotten big. And Bill Monroe has gotten big. But Uncle Dave Macon's still around. And so Banjo was String Bean. You know, Earl took String Bean's place, you know. So Banjo is String Bean, you know, two finger and then some claw hammer and then how Uncle Dave plays. And they were like the comedian. They were the guy that, you know, sang like what Oswald sang with Roy, you know, and us, you know, when I was playing with the Smokies. Oz would sing Way Downtown and, you know, with a claw hammer banjo. He had a claw hammer, you know, banjo, and he would play claw hammer style and sing Way Downtown and stuff like that. And it was funny. It was like funny stuff, you know. And so Earl comes in, you know, and so I said, okay, Earl, 1945, and I said, you come with Bill Monroe, and they introduce you, and because, you know, to us, like we hear the live things of that band on the Opry, I mean, you know, it's like Hank Aaron just hit a home run or something.
Your breath away.
Yeah, you know, just, and you could actually hear in some of them, you know, you could actually hear grown men just like, oh, you know, they can't believe what they're hearing, but I'm still picturing, you know, this guy who's 21 years old, and he doesn't know, you know, he's not Uncle Dave, and he's not a, you know, funny personality or anything, although he was a really funny guy when you got to know him because he was so intelligent. He's one of the most intelligent musicians I've ever been around, and intelligent people, period, in any line of work. But so I said, okay, Earl, I said, when did you know? And Earl said, well, you know, he said, Bill Monroe said, He said, I really was concerned that my style of playing a banjo would not be accepted. He said, I really didn't know that it would be, because all the other fellers around, Crook Brothers or Uncle Dave or anybody, they played a banjo in an entirely different way than I did. And I honestly didn't know that it'd be accepted. And he said, we played three or four weekends, you know, on a Saturday at the opera. And he said, you know, people seemed like they liked the band, and they loved to hear Bill sing high, and, you know, the blue yodels and what have you. But he said, I got to come to the opera about 3 weeks into my time with Bill. I come in and he said, the stage manager come up and said, Earl, you got some mail. He said, I never thought about them having mail. He said, I'd see Bill reading his mail. He got a lot of fan mail, you know. He'd sit over there on the bench and read it right there on stage. It wasn't no place to go. And he said, Earl, you got a letter. And I said, you sure? Yeah, you do. Well, says Earl Scruggs, care of the Grand Ole Opry, Nashville, Tennessee. Oh, well, okay. He said, I'll open it up. He said it was from West Virginia. And he said, I'll never forget it. Said, somewhere outside of, between Wheeling and Beckley. Of course, that could be about anywhere.
I love this. By the way,
oh, yeah,
you're listening to Glenn Duncan as Earl Scruggs. And this and the story's great, but you're killing me.
Oh, man. Well, it's right off the, okay. Earl would say, right off the cob.
Okay.
You know? And he said, I opened the letter up and read it, and he said, I couldn't believe what they're saying about what they heard, you know, when I played the banjo. Never heard anything like it, and, you know, just on and on and on. He said, that's when I knew. I knew right then and there that if I was able to walk up to that microphone in Nashville, Tennessee, and play the way I played a banjo, and that people as far off as up in West Virginia was liking my style of banjo picking, I knew I had something right then that I could use.
Boy, could he. Holy moly.
Yeah. Ain't that great, though? Because he didn't know.
No.
As I say to him, I say, well, you didn't know till you knew.
Till you knew. And then you knew, and then you figured it out. Boy, did he ever know.
Boy, yeah. He told a great story about Uncle Dave. He said, of course, Uncle Dave knew when Scruggs came, the banjo was going to be Earl Scruggs. It wasn't going to be Uncle Dave or String or any of them anymore. They had their thing. So, but their thing was yesterday, you know, and Earl was going to be it. And so Monroe took Uncle Dave on a tent show tour. And they got down in Florida, and they were playing, and Bill had to fly back to fulfill his Saturday night, you know, he had to be there Saturday night, and he couldn't get enough tickets for the whole band, so he left Earl and Uncle Dave in Florida, and so Lester and Chubby and Howard and Bill flew back to Nashville to play Saturday night, and getting flat on an airplane back in the 40s would have been taking an act of Congress, but somehow or another they got flat to go. And so the funny thing is, so Earl told me, he said that, and I'll do this part of my own voice, just get it across sooner. So Earl said,
this is the Reader's Digest version.
That's exactly okay. Right. So Earl told me, you know, he said, Uncle Dave said, he never ever in his life called Earl Earl. And this is that typical, you know, kind of that old-time thing. Call him Ernest. You know, call him Ernest. And so he said, Ernest? He said, that's going to be great. He said, me and you will stay there and stay here, and we'll play banjos. He said, we'll just pass, you know, you get your banjo and I'll get mine, and we'll play back and forth, you know. And of course, Earl, he said, boy, that'd be fine. And he liked Uncle Dave, you know, because Uncle Dave was entertaining.
Oh, he's a great entertainer.
big character, you know, big character to be around. And Earl's, man, he's, you know, 22 probably by then. And, you know, man, he's eating this up. You know, man, this is great. And so Monroe and Flat and then they fly back to Nashville and do the show. And so, and literally, I mean, and so Uncle Dave and Earl, you know, of course, they had to travel back then. I mean, they like, you know, they're sleeping in the in one big bed, you know. So the next morning they get up, they go eat breakfast, they come back. Uncle Dave says, well, Ernest, let's get our banjos out. And I said, boy, Uncle Dave, that'd be fine. I'd like to hear how you play them tunes. So, you know, so they get out the banjos. This is the way the whole thing went. But I'll just tell you the quick version. So Uncle Dave says, well, Ernest, he goes, he said, you play Cumberland Gap? And, boy, me and you know Earl played Cumberland Gap.
Yeah, yeah.
And so Earl starts on Cumberland Gap, and he said, I'm cutting down on Cumberland Gap. You know, he said, we both tuned up. And he said, Ernest, do you play Cumberland Gap? And I said, yeah, a little bit. And he said, I started down on it. And he said, man, I didn't get halfway through the first part. And Uncle Dave goes, oh, hey, wait just a minute here. Let me show you here. And so then Uncle Dave plays Cumberland Gap for 5 minutes. And he goes, okay, that's how you do Cumberland Gap. He said, now, how about Cotton Eye Joe? Yeah, I'll play Cotton Eye Joe a little bit, and same thing. So this goes through about 4 or 5 So Ernest and Uncle Dave playing banjos was really, Uncle Dave's going to play the banjo, and Ernest's going to go, boy, that's fine, Dave. Because he didn't let Earl play more than 20 seconds. Yeah. Take it right away from him.
Well, that was time for you know, and Uncle Dave knew it, but he was gonna let Earl know that he still in a friendly way that he still played the tunes and that Ernest had to wait a while.
That's exactly right.
Let's Glenn, there's so much more that I want to talk to you about.
Yeah.
We're gonna talk about your time with Earl. And if people are tuning in, Glenn Duncan, we talked at the first part about songwriting. Just tipped our toes into it a little bit. We've been talking about your musicianship and your relationship with Bill Monroe and Earl Scruggs. You have one more single out. I want you to introduce Roving Gambler off of this new project that's coming on EMG. And then I want to come back and talk to you more about Earl Scruggs and a tune that you recorded with him. And I don't know that it's ever been done before, that a man received a Grammy twice for the same song recorded two different times.
That's exactly right.
Yeah, let's do a little bit of a lead-in for you for Roving Gambler, then we'll come right back and talk to Glenn Duncan some more. Go ahead.
Yes, Roving Gambler. I'll tell you, there's something about, again, you know, we've been kind of talking about how these songs had a sound to them, and the guys who played these songs had a sound to them. And one thing I really loved from the first time I can remember anything about these records was I really loved what I found out, you know, later, when you start really, you know, studying it, was I loved the songs that had like the kind of old English sounding songs. Like I loved Darlin' Corey. I loved that. I loved the way the words sounded, not just what they said, but how the words sounded. So I loved all the songs like, you know, Darlin' Corey, Little Maggie. I thought, man, that's such a cool way to say it. It's not the way, and you know, it hooked everybody. You know, it hooked Bob Dylan. It hooked everybody that I've ever talked to about song. My friends in the UK, you know, Mark Knopfler. You take any of these guys who've written songs. That way of writing a song, it hooked all of us because it was not the way you would typically say it in our time. It was like from an older time. It was from an older time. And so Roving Gambler was one of those songs. I thought about that song. And really, the way, what hooked me on Roving Gambler was when I was a kid, I guess I was about 22, I started playing with Larry Sparks. I loved Larry Sparks. I'd seen him from his earliest days with Wendy and Mike. You know, Wendy Miller, Mike Lilly, that group. And, boy, there was just something about Sparks. Boy, it had the whole deal for me because rhythm was so great. I liked the way he played the guitar, and I loved just everything about his singing and everything else. So
he was the B.B. King of bluegrass guitar, in my opinion.
There you go. Mm-hmm. That's you exactly right.
Pick your one, pick your note.
One
yep.
note. Yep. One big note instead of ten, and with every kind of soul that he had on it, and I loved everything about the songs that he picked to do, and so actually he had called me to go play with him for a weekend. Gosh, this is probably 77 or 78, and so I went up, drove over to Richmond, Indiana, where he lived then. And we went, it was wintertime, boy. I mean, seriously, cold. And we went and played a bunch of stuff up in Michigan together. And one thing that happened, neither one of us have ever forgotten was, so I was, you know, steel player, little kid steel player. So I always loved that double stop fiddle thing. I mean, I loved Dale Potter, Buddy Spiker, you know, Vassar, Bobby Hicks, all the guys that played a lot of double stops, and all the classical violinists. I love the sound of two strings because I was able to do all these different chords and different chord changes and all that stuff. So we started playing Facing the Crowd on stage the first night we played together. And I started playing Facing the Crowd with the chord changes like I would play it on a steel guitar. And, boy, Sparks, I mean, he's head snapped around to me, and like, oh, my gosh, yeah. And we came off stage, he said, we just got to start doing that all the time. So we played it backstage. And so we ended up cutting, you know, three albums together after I joined the band, and we did that on a lot of songs. We did it on a song called It's Never Too Late that the Stanley Brothers had done, and we did it, you know, on that. We did it on a bunch of other songs. But it was just a way to do it. And Cordell and I did it on some songs, taking an old song and making it sound, you know, newer chord change-wise. We did it with Longview. Dudley and I put together a thing on When the Golden Leaves Begin to Fall. We did chord substitutions. And so I've used it all through my career. And when I started with Larry Sparks, he used to do Roving Gambler. Man, I loved that song. That was one of my favorite things that we did in the whole show. So that's where I was exposed to Roving Gambler sounding like the way I do it now. Because the Stanley Brothers had done it, and I love their record of it. Boy, the Sparks really had a thing on that. And, you know, he got so famous for the, you know, the killer ballads and John Deere Tractor and all that stuff. But, boy, I'm telling you, back in the 70s, Sparks capoed up in A, B flat, or B, doing My Time, or even Nine Pound Hammer, or Roving Gambler. When My Time Comes to Go, boy, I mean, as good as I ever heard still to this day. So that's where I fell in love with that song, Roving Gambler.
Well, we're going to hear Roving Gambler. When we're finished, we're going to come back, and we're not done talking to Glenn Duncan yet, so hold on just a second. Thanks, Glenn. Next week, part 2.